You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there, it's Krista Simmons, host of the Fork in the Road podcast, where every Friday I'm chatting with hospitality visionaries about big ideas in the world of food. I've written, produced, and directed in the culinary space for almost 15 years now. And I have to say, the best part of my job, aside from the food, of course, is all of the characters I've met along the way. And honestly, I'm just really excited for you guys to meet them too. So if you want to find yourself inspired, or heck, you just need some good fodder for a dinner party conversation, grab yourself a cocktail and meet me over at A Fork in the Road. We'll see you there.
Why is democracy so threatened in America and around the world? And what can we do about it? Ben Rhodes, a former White House aide and close confidant to President Barack Obama and the author of The World as It Is, travels the globe in a deeply personal, beautifully observed quest for answers. In his new book, After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. And today, Ben returns to the podcast to discuss what it was like to go from being the ultimate White House insider to reporting on world events from the outside. He talks about his conversation with the now imprisoned Russian activist Alexei Navalny, what he learned from the Hong Kong protesters, and how Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban quickly consolidated power and rolled back post-Soviet freedoms. Plus, he reveals why he believes that America is partly to blame for figures like Orban, Putin, and Xi, and he even weighs in on the government's joint intelligence report about unidentified aerial phenomenon, a.k.a. UFOs, coming up with Ben Rhodes in just a moment. Ben Rhodes is co-host of Pod Save the World, a contributor for NBC News and MSNBC, a founding co-chair of National Security Action, and an advisor to former President Barack Obama. From 2009 to 2017, he was a deputy national security advisor to President Obama. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The World as It Is. And now he's out with his latest book, After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. Ben, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks. It's been a while, you know?
Certainly has. Certainly has. The world has changed quite a bit since then.
Yes, yeah.
But
yeah.
It always does. Last time we talked about your previous book, The World as It Is, which was a little bit more of a memoir than this book, although there is a certain memoir aspect to it. The previous book sort of revolved around the pull between Ben Rhodes, the idealist who wanted to change the world, and the practical constraints of the office of the president, the realities of how the world works. But there was a little bit of coming down to earth in that book. And I wonder if it's been even more so for you over the past 4 years here.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mention that in the sense that this book, After the Fall, is, I think, more personal than the first book, which is a memoir, in the sense that, you know, in that first book, you know, I had to recount a lot of events. I had to cover basically a decade of my life and history. And here, you know, the starting point for me was I'd been completely knocked on my back after the election of 2016, and I'm looking around the world, and everything I care about seems to be moving in the wrong direction in the United States and around the world. And I had to find a way into addressing that. And for me, it became travel, and I became meeting people in other places that are wrestling with these issues of democracy versus authoritarianism. And I had to kind of, through them, you know, I had this kind of experience of being someone who was once in a position of power, being better able to understand how power works by talking to people who are basically opponents of authoritarianism, you know, the Hong Kong protesters, Russian opposition figures like Alexei Navalny, democratic activists in places like Hungary. And I had to kind of bring my story together with theirs to kind of understand what's happened in the United States and why is this happening seemingly all over the world.
Yeah, I wonder, having spent 8 years in the White House at the center of power, what was it like for you to write about more recent world affairs over the past 4 years from the vantage point of a relative outsider?
Well, it was very disorienting because, you know, I think leaving a position of power is always strange. Like, you go from being in the room where world events are being discussed and decided upon to being totally outside of that. And then when you add Trump to that mix, someone who basically is taking a, you know, a hatchet to everything you worked on and kind of dismantling the concept of reality itself, I describe in the book feeling almost like an exile, you know, in my own country. And, you know, then I go abroad and I met this young woman, Zhanna Nemtsova, a few months after leaving government in Germany, whose father, Boris Nemtsov, was killed, assassinated in the shadow of the Kremlin. And she's describing to me kind of her experience of trying to get to the truth about what happened to her dad. And in so doing, is just kind of telling me her story. And on the one hand, I felt this incredible letdown of like, I can't really do that much for this person. But then I realized, well, what I can do is I can really hear her story, get inside of it, tell her story in a book like this, and also begin to understand what's been happening in Russia through her story. And then I met a Hungarian activist around that same time, maybe a little later, who, you know, I said to him, how did you guys go from being a democracy to an autocracy in like a decade? And he said, well, it's simple. Viktor Orban, our prime minister, got elected in a right-wing populist backlash to the financial crisis. Then he packed the courts with right-wing judges, redo the parliamentary districts to keep his party in power, change the voting laws to make it easier for his supporters to vote, enrich some cronies who kind of bought up the media and turned it into a propaganda machine, and wrapped it all up in a us versus them nationalist message, you know, us, the real Hungarians versus them, immigrants, Muslims, George Soros. And so this guy's talking and I'm like, well, this sounds very familiar. And so I realized that I could have this kind of unique opportunity as someone who was recently in power, talking to these people, kind of confronting power, and through them, understand better what was happening in my own country and the world. And that to me felt like a very, you know, what do I know from having been in government? And what do these people know from having lived these issues? And if I mix those together, which is essentially what this book is, you know, can we make some more sense of this and why it's happening and what we can do about it?
Yeah, the progression of events in Hungary sounds chillingly familiar. Is that why you chose to focus on Hungary as the first country you describe in this book?
It is, because the other, I look at Hungary, then Russia, then China, then America. And, you know, early on, I think my editor was like, well, Hungary's like, you know, eccentric choice. And I'm like, no, the Hungary section is really about America, because the exact same thing has happened with a kind of a party moving to the far right and using, you know, its access to democratic institutions to kind of hack them and turn them into institutions of autocracy. And it traced my experience very acutely, too, because what I found there is how much the financial crisis in 2008 was kind of a starting point of this process, because in a place like Hungary that was pretty recently a democracy after the Cold War, the financial crisis really just collapsed their confidence in the whole system, you know, American-led globalization. Like, what I heard time and again, I told each of the people I talked to in the Hungary section, just tell me your story of, like, the last, you know, what's happened in your life. And each of them identified this idea that people were already feeling disoriented by globalization. Their identities were feeling like they were being washed away. Then this drastic thing happens where the bottom falls out, and suddenly nobody trusts anything anymore. They don't trust the system. And the system looks unequal and corrupted. And a guy like Orban comes along and says, well, I can't necessarily solve all these problems, these economic problems, but I can offer you the most traditional identity that has always existed, which is nationalism, and kind of tap into these undercurrents of history between the left and the right that had been unresolved, and then build a machine that essentially could sustain itself with that nationalist message. And I trace in the chapter, like, what Orban did in creating this kind of grassroots movement that connected to top-down power was very similar to the Tea Party in the United States, where you have this kind of grassroots anger at a lot of things, at the financial crisis, I think, frankly, a black president being elected, and powerful people kind of took that anger and just, you know, melded it into a political movement that gradually became Donald Trump, you know? And so I think we were on kind of parallel tracks with Hungary this last decade.
Yeah, there's a great quote in here. I think that Barack Obama at some point said to you, Trump is for a lot of white people what OJ's acquittal was for a lot of black folks. You know it's wrong, but it feels good.
Yeah, I mean, and Obama, like, you know, his voice pops in and out of this book. He's kind of a character in the book. And, you know, like, he was just trying to make sense of this like the rest of us. You know, like, you're just grasping for theories to explain this. And it was kind of a glib comment, but there was this kind of underlying truth in it that, like, you know, you look at the phenomenon of Trump, and I've constantly looked at these polling numbers where, like, you know, a majority of white people were on board with this project. I think there's some truth in that. Like, Trump was kind of a guilty pleasure, like, where, you know he's not fixing things, but he's speaking to some grievance that you have. And I described the experience of meeting a Trump supporter, and, you know, she just kind of willfully had entered into this alternative reality because it, again, it didn't fix her economic circumstance, but I think it made her feel like, you know, at least there was someone angry on her behalf, you know, someone taking on power on her behalf. And that, you know, that's a very powerful force, and it's something that people like Putin and Orban and Trump all have in common.
Yeah, to go back to Hungary, one of the activists that you spoke with actually pointed out that Viktor Orban's authoritarian rule is not the aberration, it's the norm. And it's this brief 10 years of liberal democracy in Hungary that was the exception to the rule. I mean, that certainly doesn't bode well for Hungary, but I'm curious to learn how much of the world fits into that same ominous profile, where it's democracy that's the experiment here.
Yeah, I mean, so Ben, how old are you?
1974. So I remember the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall and all that. In fact, I was in Moscow, I think, 2 months before the coup to overthrow Gorbachev when I was on a people-to-people trip.
I raised that because, you know, I wrestled in writing this book with the realization that as someone born in 1977, my first kind of glimmers of political consciousness were the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War. And it just felt like, you know, history's got this inevitability to it, that the norm is democracy, that that's what wins, that the political stories have happy endings, geopolitical stories have happy endings. You know, Nelson Mandela walks out of prison, the Soviet Union collapses, places like Hungary become democracies. And in talking to this guy in Hungary, you know, what he told me is that one of the interesting things is that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they didn't really address all this history, you know, that people in Hungary had been on both sides of such huge conflicts, and they'd also been the smaller country caught up in them. And so you had people who had kind of sided with the Nazis during World War II, then people who'd sided with the communists through their repressive rule, and nobody really reckoned with that, and nobody really figured out, like, well, what does it mean to be Hungarian? How do we merge together our national identity with this kind of new democracy we have? And he made this point that if you think about it, most of human history is about nationalism and conflict and tribalism. And that's not some new thing that just popped up in recent years. The strange period was this period after World War II where the history is moving in a different direction. Another guy who's kind of maybe a little younger than us, quoted this great phrase to me. He called it an elongated reason cycle. You know, that he said, look, you know, after World War II, there was such shock at the scale of death and destruction and the Holocaust that it kind of sobered nations up to, hey, we better kind of create some international institutions and rules and norms so we don't do that again, you know? You know, it's not like the Cold War was perfect by any stretch, but there was this kind of disciplining factor on the world. And now that we are moving 70, 80 years beyond that historical memory, you know, people don't have in their their collective memories, where nationalism can lead. And that's part of what kind of allows for something you know is probably not right, this kind of blood and soil nationalism that Orban represents and Putin certainly represents, creeping back in, you know, because we don't have our, you know, our parents are no longer the people who fought in World War II or who went through the Holocaust in the same way. And I think there's something to that. And we have to remind ourselves, like, hey, guys, this is not granted. Like, this is a constant struggle.
And you also spend a lot of time talking about Russia in this book. You actually interviewed, among other people, Alexei Navalny, who is at this point pretty much the current chief nemesis to Putin, I think. You spoke to him before he was jailed. I have to ask, maybe you got some sense of this from him. Why did he return to Russia knowing that he would almost certainly be imprisoned? I mean, talk about the trade-off there. Is a dissident more effective when he's out of his home country, but still has a platform on social media, able to travel, do press, as opposed to being in his country, but being jailed and basically gagged indefinitely?
I've thought about this question a lot. And there's like three things I think that answer it to me. One is he kept coming back to kind of his motivation being anger. You know, like he's so angry at the corruption all around him, the autocracy all around him. He said to me, if I ever need motivation, if I remember feeling demotivated, I would just appear before a Russian judge, because what that judge would say is so full of lies that it would give me all the motivation I need, you know? And I think he's someone that, look, there's some people, and he said this to me too, there's some people who look at how futile things look, you know, in a place like Russia and just give up, you know? And then there's some people who get angry. And he never wanted to lose that incredulous, you know, anger. This isn't right. You know, what Putin wants me to do is kind of give up, be apathetic, be cynical. Oh, nothing will ever change. And so I think he kind of kept this reservoir of anger, really, at the system and at corruption, which is his focus, to keep him going. He also said something really interesting to me in one conversation. He said, I'm not interested in being one of the Soviet-era dissidents who move abroad and talk to foreign journalists. And he said, I have great admiration for them, but I'm trying to build a political organization. I believe if I ran an election, I could beat Vladimir Putin. And I think he, when he had that chance to leave after he was poisoned, you know, I think he realized if he stayed in like a Germany, he would become less relevant in Russia. And that even if there's an enormous risk, and he said, look, I'm a normal guy. Like when they close the prison cell door behind you, I'm afraid like everybody else. But I think he realized that he had to be in Russia to be relevant. Or to be relevant in a particular kind of way, at least. And I really don't mean to diminish what some people are doing outside of countries, because everybody makes his choice for themselves, right? I mean, some of the Hong Kong protesters I talked to have had to leave Hong Kong, and I'm glad for them they did. You know, but Navalny, his whole brand is defiance and fearlessness. And then the last piece of this that reminds you that they're human beings is he also acknowledged me at one point. He's like, look, I can only do this because my wife supports me, you know, and if she didn't have my back, I would never be willing to do this. And that was so poignant to me. I kept thinking about that when you saw his wife go with him. You saw him in his last image before he was taken away to the prison cell, kind of making a heart symbol with his hands to his wife. Like, these are all people. It's a reminder that families take this on too, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Have you been able to be in touch with him since he was in prison? I assume not, but have you been in contact with anyone who's told you what's going on or how he's doing in there?
Not really. You know, I got in contact with him and I kind of was FaceTimed with him, you know, early last summer. Then he was poisoned. And I'd already kind of written most of my book at that point. And I actually ended up kind of texting with him when he was in Germany. And it was surreal because I was like, are you okay? Like, you know, what? And he was very kind of casual. He was joking around with me. And I mean, I think he's a guy who knows, you know, exactly the risk he signed on for. And to go back to Russia knowing he'd be imprisoned kind of speaks to that. And, you know, from talking to people who follow this closely, like, the one thing I did hear is when he was in poor health, and this was making headlines about a month ago, like I heard that was very real. You know, like he was not well. He was going to die if he didn't get the medical care that he ended up getting. And again, I think that shows you also that there was so much international attention on that probably helped in that regard. I mean, it shows you that we can't forget these people who disappear into prisons. And because, by the way, it seems hopeless, but here's where I'll be hopeful. Like, movements, dissidents, they fail over and over and over again until they succeed. And when they succeed, they really succeed. It's like the water rushes through, right? And so we have to just bear in mind that, like, this is never over. A guy like Putin wants you to think, yeah, it's over. Navalny's in prison. I've smashed his network. This is all settled. It's not. Like, Navalny himself is still there. And even without him, the kind of movement he built and the kind of frustration with corruption across Russia is all still there, kind of simmering underneath the surface. By the way, if that wasn't a powerful force, he wouldn't be in prison.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
Hey, this is Mark Bittman. You might know me from How to Cook Everything or The New York Times or The Bittman Project. I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability, even policy. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food, and that's why I've started a podcast called, appropriately enough, Food. Each week on Food, I'll sit down with a different guest, ranging from Samantha Irby to Tom Colicchio to Ted Danson, and to important people in the food world you may not yet know about. We'll talk about cooking, eating, and how food affects us all, our lives, our health, our planet. We'll talk recipes, ingredients, how to shop, what to cook tonight, and what you can do to help build a better food system. We'll even take your questions and give advice, cooking and otherwise. Whatever you want will be fair game, from how to boil an egg, to how to feed your picky toddler, to how to increase people's control over the role food plays in our lives. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. So subscribe now to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't miss my first episode, May 24th, with my special guest, the fabulous Nigella Lawson.
I traveled through time to tell you this. Almost everything that happens in politics today has happened before, has been debated before, maybe in slightly different forms. On my History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast, since 2006, I've been examining the history behind today's politics and adding layers of context to some of today's debates and telling some great stories. I'm Bruce Carlson. Join me at www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com or wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your podcasts from. Learn how George Washington and FDR supported vaccines in their time. Warren Harding or Ulysses S. Grant took stands on racial justice. John and Abigail Adams and what they had to say about free speech and the press. What Abraham Lincoln had to say on that. What were the conspiracy theories that had to be debated during the debate over the Constitution? Were things more partisan or less partisan in the past? We're balanced on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, so I promise you won't be infuriated even if you don't agree. We take a balanced approach. So listen, www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com.
You know, I want to ask you about the U.S.-Russian relationship. During your time in the Obama White House, following the brief period of reset, the U.S. had a largely cautious and at times tense relationship with Russia. That was now followed by a friendly or at least passive relationship with Russia under Donald Trump, the motives of which we'll perhaps never know, but we can speculate on. But now that President Biden is sort of restoring that more cautious approach, do you think Vladimir Putin sees that as simply returning to the norm, or is that ratcheting everything up now in the sense that maybe he views it as not going back to the norm, but suddenly it's more adversarial and hostile?
That's a really good question. And it probably appears more adversarial and hostile. And I think if you look at the pace of like things like cyber attacks and the nature of disinformation campaigns from Russia, this insane event where, you know, in Belarus, where, you know, clearly probably with some Russian knowledge, they basically hijack an airplane, land it to detain someone. I think he's escalating. But, you know, tracing the 20 years of Putinism for this book, it's always escalating. Like, it's just been a steady escalation of his repression at home and his kind of efforts to undermine the U.S. and the West abroad and the democratic world generally. I think where I landed in terms of what can be done differently, including like what could we have done differently in the Obama years, because we obviously didn't curtail this, at least nearly as much as I would have liked. Like one is what Putin really focuses on is what's happening in America. Like I describe it in the book as him trying to turn America into what he wants us to be, which is a divided, you know, society consumed by racism and political divisions. I mean, his disinformation campaigns, even some of the cyber activity, I think is designed to kind of turn us against one another, discredit democracy itself as an alternative. Navalny said to me, look, Putin doesn't need to prove that his model's right. He just needs to prove that all the models are corrupted. So you might as well have your own strongman, you know?
Right. He's a little bit like Batman's the Joker. It just seems like there's no particular strategy other than to just wreak havoc and sow confusion everywhere he can.
That's right. And so that means, like, what do you do differently? I mean, we have to tend to our own democracy, and there's a lot of ways to do that. But we have to tend to this other policy things that you can do, like social media. He's basically like, oh, you guys have created these algorithms through Facebook and Google and Twitter that I can just wreak havoc with, you know, and just flood them with insane conspiracy theories. And if you think for a minute that Russian disinformation hasn't played a part in turbocharging not just pro-Trump stuff, but QAnon and other things, of course, all he has to do is juice the algorithm to drive us crazier and crazier, you know. And so we need a policy that regulates this. And I know it's complicated, but, you know, look at Trump. Like, he just got kicked off Facebook and Twitter, started a blog. Nobody went to it. I mean, that kind of puts the lie to this idea that people are shopping around for Trump. No, they're getting mainlined this stuff by social media companies because the social media companies know that will trigger people, that will create more engagement, and then we're off to the races here. And so that needs a policy response. And then in terms of dealing with Putin, one of the things that started to be an idea at the very end of the Obama administration, and we didn't get to do it, is exposing Putin's corruption. And because corruption is the vulnerability in the system. And that's all Navalny really did, is just relentlessly expose corruption. Like, his last movie that he put out before he was thrown in prison was about Vladimir Putin's house, which is like the most expensive, lavish castle, palace, whatever you want to call it, in the world. And that, you know, Putin clearly, that hits at his third rail. That hits at his most sensitive nerve. Well, I'm willing to wager the U.S. government has a lot of information on kind of what that's like. It could put that out, you know, just like lay it on the table. Vladimir Putin wants to have a debate about which model is better. Look at what happens when this gets so corrupted. So there are different things to do, but I also get that, like, you know, you don't want to back into a war with Russia. But I think we have to recognize he's basically already been fighting a kind of asymmetric war as one of the Russians I talked to for the book called it a war without violence, which is actually a very interesting way of calibrating it.
You touched on something that I want to get into in that question. One of the main points that you make in this book, you say in here that, quote, the invasion of Iraq introduced a destabilizing new normal to global politics, and that we sort of set a precedent in that, quote, as you say, the laws and norms were for the weak, and the strong could do anything that they want. Is it your belief that the U.S., if not created the situation, at least set the stage for the rise of strongmen like Putin, Orban, Xi?
I think we absolutely have to recognize and acknowledge and wrestle with the fact that we contributed to this. And we like to look at Russia and China and say, look at those guys. They don't abide by any norms. They're willing to break international laws. They're willing to ignore international condemnation. But what does it say that when we had more power probably than any nation in human history in those first 10 or 15 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, what did we do with it? You know, and the most high-profile thing we did with it was invade and occupy a country, Iraq, under a false pretense against basically most of the world's opinion. How is that not contributing to it? I mean, it's just suggesting that if we are saying to the world, hey, we get to have two sets of rules, one that applies to us and one that applies to the rest of you, that's not going to work in your interpersonal relationships. Why would it work in your foreign policy and your approach to politics? So I do think that this kind of post 9/11 hyper-securitized American approach to the world, and then with Iraq as its centerpiece, was incredibly damaging. The other thing that I point out is that after there were no weapons of mass destruction, the kind of post facto justification for the Iraq war was democracy. Oh, actually, we're trying to bring democracy to Iraq. And that was incredibly damaging to our ability to talk about democracy around the world, because it just sounds like it sounded like democracy became seen as totally tied up with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, and then even under Obama and Libya, like this was incredibly corrosive to our capacity to go to, like, say, Hong Kong and talk about democracy. So again, I think, you know, part of what I want to challenge us as Americans to do with this book is, like, to recognize that, hey, we just had 30 years where we were by far the most influential country, and this is the outcome of that. What can we learn from that? And I think this is one thing that we can learn, that you can't expect your own hypocrisies and contradictions to not be replicated by others.
I wonder if your conversations with these activists around the world maybe changed your perspective, or I don't know if you maybe even had some regrets about any kind of actions that took place during the Obama era.
It did. I mean, I talked to just one example, and I would talk to some people in Hong Kong, and one young person who's particularly active in the protest movement there, you know, mentioned that what they don't need are these kind of cookie cutter statements that call for de-escalation and dialogue and things like this. And I talk about realizing that, well, I'd written statements like that. And then underneath that, more profoundly realize that, you know, why do we not prioritize more things like democracy and human rights with China? Well, I could rationalize it. In our first term, we had a global financial crisis. And in order to save the global economy, we wanted China to pump more money in the global economy, to spend more money. And that always takes priority. And then in the second term, we had, again, what I think is a very good impulse. We wanted China to do more to fight climate change. And so when we went to Beijing, Obama went to Beijing at the height of the first big Hong Kong protest movement, the Umbrella Movement in 2014, that was not as big an issue as climate change. And what it made me realize generally is I was a part of an apparatus that was certainly the case in the Obama years, but I would argue, you know, it's been pretty constant in the last 30 years. If you're China looking at us and you're thinking, what do these people care about? Making money, national security, technological advancement, democracy. Can we really honestly say that democracy was an equal priority to those other things? In some ways, should we talk about democracy? But we've gone to the mat with China, you know, over like soybean purchases, you know, in trade wars more than over the Hong Kong protesters. And I think I had to realize that, like, even though I cared about those things and thought I was earnestly working on their behalf, that it was not. I mean, I have this other description of looking at Shanghai one night when I was there in 2017, and like, it looks like the future, right? And it looks like the Blade Runner skyline, the lights sparkling out the water, and there are people taking selfies, you know, with selfie sticks, and you feel like you're in the future. And I'd also just recently had a disorienting experience of being woken up in my hotel room by some Chinese officials who were warning me not to meet the Dalai Lama. And that was particularly weird because we hadn't announced that meeting, right? It was so someone was in somebody's email, right? And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, on the one hand, this looks incredibly familiar. I'm a New Yorker. It looks kind of like the 2.0 version of New York. But it's like if you took all of American capitalism and technology mania and national security obsession, and you just stripped out the democracy, like, you would get Shanghai, you know? And so that's where, you know, again, like, we have to realize that we have not cared about democracy and human rights at anywhere near the same degree of prioritization under successive administrations, including the one I was a part of, with like a China, in the same way we've cared about making money.
Right. But there has been some progress in the sense that the U.S. has been grappling with the fallout of our own excesses as the dominant superpower for so long and trying to learn from these lessons more recently, in no small part thanks to you and your former boss, President Obama. But, you know, can we count on these other countries who are now following our worst example to eventually reach that same epiphany, especially given the history that they have?
Yeah, I mean, I do find hope in this, in the sense that, like, first of all, like you said here, there's just a much more advanced conversation about this stuff than a decade ago. And, like, I would have liked Obama to do more to create structural change, say, in our economy, in dealing with inequality, or in democracy, and dealing with some of the structural issues around, you know, voting and participation and the rest of it. But it was really not ripe. I mean, like, there wasn't a constituency for a lot of that stuff. Now it feels like there's a kind of groundswell on all these issues I'm talking about, like, hey, these social media platforms need to be reformed, and hey, what's going on with these voter suppression laws, and hey, we need structural change to deal with inequities in our economy. Like, that is hopeful to me. And then at the same time, you see a lot of mass mobilization around the world. Hong Kong movement, a Belarus movement, climate strikes. There's these huge movements against inequality in Latin America. Like, there's a sense out there, I think, even in Hungary, there's some hope. The opposition is united. They've got the best shot that they've ever had at taking out Viktor Orban in next year's election because they've essentially said, like, it's all hands on deck, you know? And so I think there is a hope that before it's too late, hopefully, that not only can the United States begin to address these things, but we can kind of connect this sense, particularly among young people globally, that things are just moving in the wrong direction. And how can we learn from each other about different strategies, whether they're political strategies or kind of protest strategies, to push back so that the pendulum swings back in the other direction? Because, you know, it sounds weird, Ben, but one of the things that gives me hope is that everybody thought this was settled in the other direction 30 years ago, right? Oh, inevitably, China will become more democratic over time. Inevitably, things are going to get better. Well, that wasn't inevitable, and it's not inevitable now that the future belongs to Putin and Xi and Trump and the rest of these guys. But it takes, I think, a pretty substantial global awakening, and hopefully that's happening.
Well, in terms of the U.S., can we still rely on these guardrails of our democracy at a time when we really can't even agree on what democracy is or what democracy is supposed to look like?
We can't. I think we learned in the Trump years that the guardrails, you know, that to use a like the wonky word, but so much of our democracy depended on norms as much as kind of firm guardrails. Like, you know, nobody. I mean, the first time I remember thinking about this was before Trump even took office. Like, there actually weren't laws about preventing someone from seeking foreign interference in an election because just nobody assumed that someone would do that, you know? And I think part of what Trump demonstrated is, you know, if you're willing to try to abuse every norm, you know, if you're willing to turn your Justice Department into a vehicle to go after your political opponents, or you're willing to spread disinformation and false information every day, like, nothing just automatically stops that. Democracy is a living organism. You know, democracy depends on what individual people do. And because the political apparatus is so broken, the Republican Party is like hopelessly lost, I think, for a generation in this kind of dark place that it's migrated to. It's going to kind of require like a whole of society effort to push back on that. And what I mean by that is, like, take the voting rights thing. Joe Manchin comes out. I don't want to support this bill. Okay, well, I want Joe Biden and the Democrats in Congress to keep pushing on this and to break that bill apart and try to get anything passed that they can to make progress at the federal level. But look, it's also going to take people at the local level getting involved. It's going to take organizations like Stacey Abrams that are registering people. It's going to take private sector companies standing up and saying, like, hey, you know, we can't support politicians who do this anymore. It's going to take, you know, the entertainment industry in this country, like, feeling like they're a part of these debates. Like, some people don't like that. Like, after BLM, some people didn't like, you know, why do we have to hear from the NBA players about this stuff? But actually, that's what it's going to take, is like enough of a cross section of American society saying, like, we don't want to lose democracy, because it's pretty obvious what the agenda is on the other side. It's not to like win elections fairly and then govern around a set of policies. It's just about power and claiming power and locking other people out of power. And so it's going to take a lot of people pushing back against that.
For sure. And there are some pretty good action items in here for the American people. We really need to do some soul searching, the same kind that you did during the Obama era about our role in the world and being more proactive and protecting our democracy. Real quickly before we go, because you are a former deputy national security advisor, and it is the week of the big UFO report, I have to ask you about UFOs. Now, I know that they have a special term for it, but practically we all call them UFOs. President Obama recently acknowledged that there are things entering our airspace that we do not have an explanation for. And of course, as I mentioned, the Intelligence and Defense report is coming out this week. To the extent that you can even talk about something like this, was that a concern when you were in the White House? Was there that much attention in the national security circles in the Obama White House to this sort of thing? And what's your best guess as to what's going on?
You know, there wasn't. I wish there was more attention. I mean, I guess this is another regret, but like, My memory of this, right, is that there some of these dots that have been connected and come out, like Harry Reid, the senator who was a majority leader at the time, everyone knew he was very focused on this issue and making sure there was funding for it. And you did start to hear some of these reports of just kind of things that didn't make sense in terms of things that had been witnessed by pilots. But it was still this kind of eccentric thing, you know, like I, because it could have been explained by any number of other things. And so there was an eccentricity to it. And by the way, also, to make a serious point about this, like the US government is really good at finding things that it goes out to look for, in the sense that we've spent trillions of dollars kind of finding the threat of terrorism. Like, and I describe in the book, like getting these intelligence reports about like the minutiae of terrorist threats in obscure countries. But if you go to the intelligence community and say, hey, here's like hundreds of billions of dollars, come back to us with the terrorist threats, like you get that. There had never been, until Harry Reid really kind of focused on this, a concerted effort to say, hey, there should be some place in the US government that is just trying to figure out, are there UFOs, you know? And I actually think that's, like, given the societal consequences of that discovery, like, that's worth some investment. I mean, you have to be careful, right? Because people need food on the table. Like, so I'm glad that there are people, because in a methodical way, putting this together. So it's not just like, hey, we saw some videos that seem weird. It's like, no, wait a second. Like, top to bottom, soup to nuts. Like, what are we seeing with these phenomena? What are threads that we can pull on this? And I think Ben, we're at the beginning of this process, not the end. You know, there's something out there that we don't understand, and we have to figure out how we can understand it better.
And there are many people who speculate that it may not be from outer space at all, that these may be coming from our adversaries, Russia or China, and they have some kind of hypersonic technology that we don't have yet or don't understand yet. But I wonder which would concern you more, that someone from outer space whose intentions we really don't know is visiting the Earth, or that, you know, our hostile adversaries who we know their intentions may have this kind of technology?
That's a good question. I mean, it is certainly the case that, like, Russia in particular, because they can't match our defense budget, and this is the same thing to a lesser extent with China, they invest in kind of eccentric things, you know, like new systems. They're trying to kind of beat, kind of hack us, like, and not just literally hack us, but like, what's the way around the kind of, we can't win a conventional war with America, so we're just going to invest in everything from new ways of delivering nuclear weapons and new ways of spying on you. These radiation weapons that seem increasingly like they come from Russia, these kind of sonic attacks people may have read about. This is kind of the game with them, which is concerning because they're basically figuring out how to puncture your defenses. That said, I mean, at the end of the day, we at least know what that is. You know, like I you know, I've seen enough disaster movies with the aliens where it's like when they make a decision, if that they're that superior, they want to do something to kind of extract all your resources, like they'll do that. I guess the hopeful thing might be is if someone has had the capacity, some being, to do this, and they haven't destroyed us yet, then maybe their intentions are better, and they're just kind of studying our habits and stuff. So I'm going to go with the alien scenarios are scarier, but also more hopeful too, you know?
Hopefully. We shall see. Well, it's great talking to you again, Ben. Once again, Ben's book is After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. And of course, go and subscribe to his podcast, Pod Save the World. Ben Rhodes, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Ben. It was great.
Thanks again to Ben Rhodes for coming on the show. Order After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to Ben's podcast, Pod Save the World, wherever you like to listen, and follow him on Twitter at B Rhodes. That's B-R-H-O-D-E-S. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at @KickassNewsPod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Kickass News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.